Hello listeners and welcome to this week's episode of The Cult Vault. I'm your speaker Casey and this episode is another instalment highlighting the problems within the troubled teen industry. Today we are going to briefly cover two programs, Three Springs and Stone Mountain for Boys, both in North Carolina. A quick reminder before we get started, follow, like and comment on any of my social media content across November to be automatically entered into a memoir giveaway of Helen Zuman's book Mating in Captivity, a story that captures Helen's time on Zendik Farm. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook at Cult Vault Pod. Also, thank you to those who took the time to subscribe to my YouTube channel. I really appreciate it. And anyone else who has a YouTube account can find me on there at Cult Vault Pod. All the subscriptions really help. If you have a spare 5 minutes, please leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts to help push the show up through the algorithm and allow more people to find it. And lastly, for anyone interested in supporting the show financially, I do have a Patreon that has exclusive content ready and waiting, with new stuff released each month at patreon.com/thecultvault. Now here is Andrew. Hi, Andrew, and welcome to the show. Thank you for agreeing to chat with me today and to shed more light on this troubled teen industry that we've covered so much on the show already. Would you like to start by introducing yourself to the listeners?
My name is Andrew. I live in North Carolina. I started this journey back when I was 9 years old. Once I graduated teen, the wilderness camps, try to fit in, and then I wound up dropping out of high school and battled a drug addiction for 10 years. So I've been sober now for 4.5 years and is giving back to the community with peer support programs.
So you've had quite a turbulent time sort of before, during and after your time spent within these therapeutic programs.
The transition was rough. Coming from a wilderness camp into a public school system that I haven't been in for five years, it was a difficult transition, and mm-hmm. I wasn't prepared for it.
And the transition is not something I don't think we've touched on too much in the coverage so far. It's definitely something that's been mentioned, but not something that's been the sole focus of one experience or another. So perhaps that can be one of the biggest takeaways from this episode today with your experience might be actually talking about the reintegration into typical society for somebody that has been in such an insular community and such a something so separated from everyday life. And, you know, these wilderness programs are often in the middle of nowhere where it's just you living with your peer group and the staff away from civilization and the rest of the world. Is that kind of how you feel your experience was?
You become institutionalized real quick. I mean, it's really, and I mean, once we get more into it, the first program I went to wasn't bad. The second one I went to is the one that I really had a struggle with, and it's the one that I had the most memories of, because it was, there's levels to these wilderness camps, and there's your low security programs, and then there's your one step below juvie programs. At least when I went back in 2005 is when I went.
You've talked about two programs there, and you've said that the first one wasn't too bad in comparison to this second program that you attended. What was the name of the first wilderness program you were sent to?
So the first one was Stone Mountain School. It's in Black Mountain, North Carolina. The executive director at the time was named Kat Jennings, C-A-T Jennings. And she is now a director of another program. It's called the Asheville Boarding School for Girls, that is located on the same campus that this program was shut down in 2007. If my information serves me right, that this program, Stone Mountain, was shut down due to non-compliance. They also work hand-in-hand with SUS, S-U-W-S, that is a notorious program for goon squatting children. When I mean goon squatting, I mean waking kids up in the middle of the night and forcing them into a van. And next thing you know, you're in the middle of Idaho or some random state in a field. I personally haven't been goon squatted, but I've seen people that have.
This first program that you attended, Stone Mountain, it was closed down eventually, but the person that was kind of involved with that program renamed, rebranded, and reopened a new institution under a different name.
Yes.
And that seems to be another common theme that we see within these types of wilderness programs and therapeutic boarding schools. Often, when they're shut down, the staff disperse and open up new programs in different states or stay where they are and just give the program a new name.
Essentially, yes. There's a website. I can't remember. I think it's like heal, I think it's heal.org or heal something. It's basically a place you can report the staff members to. And I was just randomly in the mountains about a month ago and was like, I just want to go walk around the campus. And next thing I know, there's a brand new wilderness camp here. And I'm like, and nothing has changed with this campus. I mean, the buildings are the same. I don't know as far as like the curriculum, but it's still the same campus that I remember 15 years ago. I'm 31 now. So, I mean, when I went, I was 10 years old at the time.
And you mentioned that this first program that you were sent to was not particularly too difficult to be involved in. So what do you think it was about this program that was bearable?
Well, I had a troubled family history. So my family divorced in 96, so I was 6 years old. My grandmother died when I was 9, and I was in this like 3 year period of transitioning. So when I was 6 years old, when my family divorced, I went to go live with my aunt, my grandmother. And then when this happened, they said I had ADHD, so they put me on Ritalin, and I was taking Ritalin as a first grader, and then Ritalin moved into Adderall. And I kept getting in trouble at school, but it was just impulsiveness. And then when my grandmother died, it kind of flipped me upside down. And when this happened, I remember my mom coming back in the picture and saying, hey, I want my son. So I got taken away from that stable environment into my mom's house. And it became really turbulent. There's a lot of physical and verbal abuse going on. And it wound up me becoming a troubled teen. So I got expelled from Catholic school, and I went from being a sheltered goody-goody kid to being transferred to a public middle school in the ghetto. And I got picked on and bullied a lot for it. So I tried to join a sports team, and then instead of the sports team becoming a safe haven to make friends, it became a safe haven for the kids to bully me in a locker room. So I became real. Like just real distressed and real tough at a young, when I was about 7 or 8 years old. No, because I was nine, because my grandmother died, I was nine, 99. So yeah, so 99 is when I was going to this middle school, and 2000, I wound up getting expelled from it because I wound up assaulting a police officer and the principal, and a lot of it had to do with the medication I was on because during this time it was. We can't fix the kid, but medication can fix the kid. So we'll just keep sending the kid from medication to medication, and eventually something has to work. And in the 90s, this was considered a cookie cutter child. There was really no definition other than just passing them off of pills. And this has a really big impact on my drug addiction because when I wound up battling a 5 year addiction to methamphetamine, I contributed to the fact that I was prescribed Adderall and Ritalin at such a young age that I learned to like stimulants. So, and when I was 10 years old, my dad wound up picking me up after being expelled from school. And he took me to a Beyond Scared Straight program ran by the Lexington Jail. And actually, this sheriff was involved in a huge scandal in North Carolina. And so he wound up dropping me off, signing my name over to the sheriff. And then the sheriff wound up taking me behind like behind the scenes. So I was like in a holding cell, dressed out, like meeting maximum security inmates, and they put me inside of a holding cell on the maximum security floor. And like, this is supposed to scare you straight, but it wound up making me even more callous than what I was. It turned me from loving my family to me feeling like an outcast and a misfit, that I would never be changed. And this started down the road of the wilderness camps. Because once I got out of the jail tour, my dad didn't believe that they put me in a solitary confinement room and shut the lights out on me for 5 to 10 minutes. So that way I could hear the noise of the other inmates and like, this isn't where you want to be at. And it wound up turning me into a whole different person. So when I showed up to Stone Mountain School in 2001, I was about to be 11, but I was only 10 and a half at the time. It was a reprieve for me. And it was a release from the family, and I enjoyed it. I enjoyed this program, and I feel like the job I work now, I see kids that go down the same path I do with their family not taking care of their mental health or trying to send it from place to place. So they find a way to either run away, escape with drugs, or escape through mental hospitals because it's a vacation. So that's my childhood right there. And that plays a huge part into the next role of the wilderness camps.
I think the word you used there with turbulent is such a great way to try and summarize these experiences that you've had growing up, because it sounds as if when your parents divorce, it's the start of that turbulence. And then you go through so many transition periods so quickly where you then go to live with your aunt and your grandmother, and then you have the death in the family. So then you're grieving, and then you go to a new school. You're trying to adapt to all these new medications, and you're also trying to struggle with the learning difficulties that you have at the same time that aren't being addressed in the way that maybe they should be. And then you have on top of that, the bullying, the school expulsion, and then this strange experience in this scared straight scenario, which didn't have the desired effect on you that perhaps the prison officers were hoping it would have.
Yeah, because I wound up going to, because when I got expelled from the second school, the middle school, I got bullied out and I got expelled there. Well, before I got expelled, they wanted me to go in a teen court. And so I went to teen court, and then they sent me on another Beyond Scared Straight program. But this time it was to the state prison of Raleigh and the minimum security camp in Salisbury. And so those two specific ones was the one that was the tipping point for me, because it scared me, but it just made me feel like I was unloved.
This period in your life, there are so many different things that are happening at the same time that this is, I'd say, definitely a pinnacle point where you probably needed some intervention, but it didn't come in the right form.
Yeah. And I don't blame my parents looking back on it, because they were doing the best they could with the situation that they had. You know, like, I really wish in the process of it all was the accreditation from the wilderness camp. So when I went to Stone Mountain, it was pretty typical. I mean, I showed up, they went through my stuff, and they allowed us to go to school, and we went on hiking trips. I mean, some of my best memories were from this school, was for just the hiking and learning how to survive on your own and going to school. But I was away from my family. And so I don't really remember too much brainwashing per se, but I don't remember a lot of like trying to reintegrate people into the community. It was essentially, you have four levels in the program, and then once you complete the fourth level, then you can go on to graduate. And I guess that's where the transition period was, but I think a lot of it with this program was more like the oddities of it. I mean, I stayed in a campsite, and I mean, I remember having a bucket out back, and every night you had a bucket. It was a plastic 5 gallon bucket, and you had to pee in the bucket because they wouldn't allow you to go outside to the outhouse. So then we had pee bucket duty, and it seriously sounds like it is. You had to basically carry this bucket full of pee up a hill and dump it in the outhouse in the morning time. Like, I remember one time falling up this hill and pee slosh all over me, and I had to go take a shower. So I had to walk about a mile up the campsite to go shower. But I don't know why this program got shut down. I really don't. I know they wanted you on a lot of medications. That was the one thing I do remember. It was like I was always in a psychiatrist's office, and he was always prescribing medications.
Do you think that was quite typical for a lot of your peer group as well?
Yeah, so the typical group is 12 people. They split you off into groups. So it was 10 to 12 people, like 10 years old to 12. And then they had a second group, 1, 2, 3, see Mohican, Pioneer. Five groups in total from 10 to 17 years old.
And what was the average length of this particular program at Stone Mountain?
So typically it was they geared it as a 12-month program, I stayed there for up to 18 months because the way the level system worked is you have orientation, and it's your basic, like, getting to know your peers and the names, and you have to have staff sign off. So every night we have a group huddle, and during these huddles we go through our daily, our day. So, like, do we have a good day? Do we have a bad day? Like, what are our problems with your group members? And so we did that. And then level one was all about your privileges. So your tool privileges. You have to have tool privilege to be able to use an axe or, like, any sharp objects. If you don't have this privilege, then you can only use, like, a shovel or a rake or your hands. So everything was based off of privileges. So tool privilege, like, swimming privileges, you couldn't go swimming if you don't have that. Your fire building privileges, you can't build a fire for your campsite if you don't have that privilege. So, and like, in order to earn these, you have to go through steps of demonstration. So, like, tool privilege, you have to demonstrate you know how to use every single tool, sharpen and clean it. Swimming, you have to take a swimming test. Fire, you have to build a fire with a bow drill. No, that was another one. You had to build a fire from flint and steel and make that survive for 10 minutes. Then, like, level two, I remember having, like, respect. You had to have every single staff member sign off on a respect sheet. So essentially what it means is if you have a staff member, let's say John Doe, you have to go up to John Doe and say, hey, Mr. John, can I talk to you one-on-one? What do I have to do to earn your respect? And they say, okay, you already have my respect. Like, you've been polite and respectful, and everything I ask of you is good to go. So I'll sign off. But let's say you have one staff member, and this happened to me. I had one staff member who just had a resentment towards me. And I remember him specifically not liking me at all. His name was Jamie Bailey. And he would not sign off on this sheet. And let's say he signs off on it. And let's say about a week goes by and you disrespect him. Well, he can choose to to scratch off his name on this sheet. So then you should go back a level. So let's say you're on level four and you lose this level two respect. You go back to level two, and you won't go back to level four until you get this respect privilege. And I think that's where a lot of the manipulation comes in with this program. And it's basically they can withhold your graduation date, or they can withhold specific things because if, like, let's say you don't participate in a group activity because you got kicked out of the group and you're a level 2, 3, 4, whatever, you lose that participation. You go back to orientation. So you are a brand new person altogether. So you go to the back of the line, you eat last, you don't get anybody respecting you as the oldest group member. You're pretty much ostracized, and, like, you can tell who's in trouble because of how the line is made. So it goes by the highest level down to the lowest level. Lowest level's in the back.
Right, okay. And
I know it's a lot, but it's, like, the only way I can, like, explain that.
Yeah, I think that's very, it's painted a very clear picture. And I think it has really helped to show us the hierarchy that's in place and the abuse of power that some of the staff will be using in terms of taking their name away from you if you do something that displeases them, that might not necessarily be something that warrants them taking their name off of the respect sheet altogether.
That wasn't the only one of this program, because honesty was another one that I remember. And essentially, honesty is the same as that concept. It's just, are you dishonest? Are you trustworthy? But if you have honesty, then you can leave the group. So like, let's say the kitchen, you need, like, let's say it's the weekend. So on the weekend, you only eat at the campsites. You don't eat up front in the main kitchen. So let's say you need something from the cafeteria or whatever. You can have a group member say, hey, can I use my honesty? Can I go up and get X, Y, and Z? And they're like, yeah, that's cool. So you can literally just have whatever you want to do during that period. And I think a lot of that too, you know, people just got tired of it. You know, people got real sick of camping out, because like, because level two is when your family can take you off campus. So you can go off campus with your family for the weekend, come back and everything. And that's where I stayed. I stayed on level two because I got up to level three. I was almost level four and I got taken away. I got the honesty taken away. And then I had that resentment with the respect getting taken away. And I mean, and it's not just these specific ones that get taken away. These are just the hardest ones to earn back, because the staff can literally just say no and come up with some excuse. But I mean, they can literally take away anything you want. I mean, a fire gets out of control, they take your fire privilege. I remember one time specifically, they had a punishment called field punishment, and you would literally go sit in a field in a chair by yourself for days. I mean, you would sleep in this field. I remember one kid being out there for at least 14 days, just by himself, rain, sleet, snow, whatever. And you come back out of the field and you literally have nothing. You have to re-earn every single level. So they reset your whole program.
That's awful, especially because when you first mentioned having the responsibility of taking the bucket to the outhouse in the morning, I thought, oh, maybe they don't want young adults and young boys and girls walking around in the wilderness at night time to go use the outhouse to go to the toilet. But then obviously if boys and girls are sleeping in the field at the same time, then that's not something. Only boys. Oh, I didn't realize. Boys. I didn't realize it was just.
Yeah, it was only boys.
Okay, and you're 11 at the time, so you're in this program, highly, highly controlling program. How long do you spend there?
I spent 18 months at this one.
And then did you transfer straight into the other program, or did you go home for a period first?
So my mom has mental health problems. I didn't know this at the time, but now that I'm on the other side, I realize, you know, my mom couldn't take care of me. And my dad decided to pay for me to go to summer school at Oak Hill Academy. It is one of the most prestigious schools in America. Carmelo Anthony graduated from Oak Hill High School. He's an NBA basketball player. He went to Syracuse for a year, and then that's how he's in the NBA now. But I remember going to the school, and I didn't know how to make friends. I didn't know how to even interact with peers.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the stuff of being institutionalized is I didn't know about, like, so when I left, I mean, Eminem just dropped his Slim Shady album. You know, like, I am the real Slim Shady. And when I come out, you know, they're talking about new artists and new music and movies, and I'm stuck. You know, I basically quit being a kid when I was 10 years old. And then when I left at 12, going on 13, you know, like, I had this gap, so I couldn't fit in, and I wound up getting in a lot more trouble at the school. And I remember this school having it wasn't a wilderness camp, but I guess like it was their way of backwoods Virginia. If you get in trouble, you're going to go dig ditches, you know, you're going to go swing an axe on the backside of a hill. And I mean, I remember doing this forever, and I wound up getting kicked out of Oak Hill. But there was no transition. There was no like psychiatrist there to talk to me. There was nobody Like, even when I left Stone Mountain, I get that I didn't graduate, but if they would have, like, been like, hey, like, you're not going to be here anymore, like, let's spend a week on how to reintegrate Andrew back into normal middle-class society,
mm-hmm.
or even low-class society, and there was nothing. So I disintegrated, you know? And so I got kicked out of there, and then my dad, they didn't know what else to do with me, because the no public school system wanted me back home, and we can just send him here. I don't know what else to do, so my hands are tied. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if they thought this one through at all. But next thing I know, I'm showing up at this school in 13 and a half, maybe 14. I remember a big burly guy with a mustache named Mr. Lynch, like 6'5", 240 pounds, pulling me into a side room, and he's like, told me to strip. And I said, what? He's like, don't make me tell you again, boy. Like, strip down, hand me your clothes, and bend over and cough. And that defining moment made me lose my whole childhood. Like, that one moment of having to bend over and cough for a grown man at 13 years old changed my whole outlook on life.
And that was a procedure that was quite common amongst new people going to attend Teen Challenge.
Yep. And I didn't know until I was there. But this was one step below juvenile hall. So there were kids coming off of a van in shackles, like handcuffs and shackles at the waist, that were court ordered to be there. And if they weren't, they didn't complete this program, then they would go to prison for, I don't know, whatever their sentences are. I mean, I remember one kid, his name was Jamal, and he was huge for 14 years old, you know? And he wound up getting a huge fight and got kicked out. But I mean, it was just that I became a sheltered little kid to learning how to stand up and fight for myself. And that defining moment. This program is a lot more rigid too. You didn't go off campus. You didn't interact with any students. I remember walking. So there's one, I think there's five groups, and they're ranging from like 13 to 17, because I was in the youngest group. Anytime you walked and there was another group coming down the sidewalk, like let's say you're walking down the left sidewalk and the group's coming down the right side, so you have to turn your head to the left so that way you don't see the other group, like, so you can never interact. It's what we call mixing. You can't mix with the other students there. So I only knew the 12 people that were in my group at one time. That was it. That was the only people I knew. I remember people that got in trouble and you got pulled out of the group and you got sent to the lynch mob and you went down gravel roads carrying buckets of gravel. I mean, it was so labor force. There was so much labor there at that school. Like if you left your water bottle at the campsite and you're up at the kitchen, then you carry a rock with you all day.
Yeah, so it's Three Springs in Pittsburgh, North Carolina.
And you've arrived at this second program. You are
13.
Around about 13 years old. What are your first impressions when you arrive at Three Springs?
Wide-eyed and bushy-tailed.
Is it another one of these programs that's kind of in the middle of nowhere?
This one was not in the mountains, but it was just in the middle of nowhere. I mean, nobody knows this town.
Right. And you have a peer group of about 12 people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how are you first introduced to that group? Do you all arrive around about the same time into the program, or have some people already been there a while when you're introduced to them?
Yeah, it's a huddle. Essentially, you sit around a campfire type setting. So the way the benches, like all the benches there were trees cut down, and then they made the tree logs into like a bench. Mm-hmm. So just imagine like two logs for your backrest and two logs to sit on, and that's how they made the huddles. And they're around a campfire, so you show up and you have to stand up in front of everybody and tell them why you're here, what your problem is, and expose, like, okay, I'm a disrespectful little teenager who doesn't like to listen to adults, and that is why I'm here. And some of them have been there for generally it's a year long program. I mean, I may have known somebody that was there for like 16 months, but yeah, because you had to have been, because I just talked to a guy about this the other day. There's a guy named Little Nate, and Little Nate had legitimate mental health problems. And this kid broke my heart because he was just really impulsive, and he got ostracized real early, and he was always carrying buckets of gravel and doing manual labor. I mean, the way our trails are made, they're like rocks, so the rock paths, and you have to have the rocks stacked up on top of each other. So you have to have one rock on top of each other and make it a trail. And imagine like every tree has a circle of rocks, and every path has rocks, and everywhere you walk is literally rocks.
Oh my
so
goodness.
They would make him pick up every single rock one by one in a wheelbarrow and put it in a pile somewhere else down like an emergency road or somewhere, and then make him carry the rocks one by one. So he had to go to the wheelbarrow, pick up one rock, and carry it back over and remake the trails. So rock by rock, he would rebuild every single trail and every single tree around Three Springs. And they told him that that is how his mother feels, trying to pick up his pieces and can't get anything right. And he was there before I was there. And then, so they go by medical record numbers, and mine was 1031. The guy I was talking to was 1052. And he said when he left, Little Nate was still there. Like, I don't even know how long this kid was there for, but he legitimately needed mental health problems, but he was just stuck here in the middle of nowhere. Like,
not necessarily receiving any of the type of support that he needed to start some type of recovery journey or improving on his well-being. It sounds like the type of place that when you arrive and you see all of these stone paths and walls that have been built, they might not cross your mind what they represent. And then as you kind of become more familiar with the program and realize that all of these have been built by previous residents of the program, and the whole place is sort of surrounded by all these paths and walls that have been built by people, it must be quite a sight really to then realize that, oh, this is now what I'll be contributing towards.
I mean, like, that too, but when I look back on it, because I actually went back by this place, and it's really weird about how this specific program shut down, because I've tried investigating this, and I've pulled back tax records, and I can't find any dissolvement of this program. I don't know, like, I think they wind up getting sued, and then in the process, it's now just barren, and the church was supposed to buy it, but the church never bought it, and it's just 40 acres of land in the middle of nowhere, and it's listed at $1.3 million, but there's no newspaper articles, there's no, like, information on the staff that went there. I mean, like, there's still medical records that are in the office still, that is just unclaimed. It's really eerie. And when I look back on it, you know, and how barren this landscape was, I almost just feel horrible for the kids that went through and still do go through these type of programs. I know there's still programs like this out there. It's that once you get out, it's the transition period, you know, and that's the biggest focus. It's not so much like what the schools have done or what they do to the parents, because we hear that so much in the media and on Reddit and whatever forums and podcasts, but we don't ever talk about the kid that once he leaves here and is institutionalized, trying to go back to a high school and then fitting in with the wrong crowd, because all the misfits are the ones that are going to love you, you know, like, you didn't go to elementary school and middle school and high school with these people. Like, you're just an outcast to these people because they don't know who you are. You're like the new kid on the block. But at least the new kid on the block understands, like, the media and can relate to these kids and can talk about the president that just, that 9/11 just happened, or to talk about Jay-Z dropping his new album. You know, I don't know none of this. Like, I've had this period of time in my life that's a blackout from 9 and a half, 10 years old to 15 and a half going to high school. You know, there's this gap in my life that I cannot explain and nobody else understands except for who's actually been through it.
Something that I still don't understand, even after hours of listening to people's testimonies and stories around their experiences, and it's something that I will never fully comprehend or understand because it's not something I've personally been through, but I think it is very prevalent what you're saying about that reintegration into society. And so much happens at that time in your life, sort of the ages between 12 and 15 or 12 to even 18, so much happens in that period of your life where you feel like you know everything and you know the kind of person you are and who you want to be when you grow up, and you feel like you've got it all figured out. But really, we don't know anything at that time. And it's a period in our lives when we should be nurtured and taken care of and have good examples set for us and be supported in learning who we are and finding out who we are. And these programs just don't facilitate that in any way whatsoever. And so you've come out of your experience of your kind of 4 to 5 years involved in these programs with absolutely no idea how to communicate with somebody who hasn't been through one of these wilderness programs themselves. I imagine, especially with the programs where you're expected to have these, like, you use the word huddle, and I'm not sure, I'm sure we can go into this a bit more soon, but when people have these experiences where they do the scream and shout therapy, and they have the sessions where they're supposed to divulge their most deepest and darkest secrets, even if what they're saying isn't true, because they just want to be left alone and they don't want the spotlight on them anymore, so they make up sleeping with 4 or 5 guys, which is not true because they're still a virgin or whatever it is that the situation kind of presents itself. And then you've got to go back to mainstream education where you're not expected to say these things and have these conversations. And then it's almost like difficult not to overshare or not to speak about your deepest, darkest secrets with everybody you meet, because that's just what you've done for the last 5 years. So it's very interesting that you've touched upon kind of the reintegration being something that you struggled with.
I struggled with it a lot, because I mean, even when I was like, I remember going to high school and I was a sophomore. My sister sat down and she went over this like list of programs and classes, and looking back, you know, hindsight is 2020, because I would have joined. Because 9/11 happened, so that's 2011, 2021. Yeah, so I was 21. Okay, yeah, I keep getting 2001 and 2011 mixed up, but I would have joined the army or like the military, because that was like the only structure I knew, and I kind of feel like that was like the only option, but I didn't do it. So I just found the wrong crowd, you know, found people that it wasn't like, oh, I got out and I just started smoking weed. It was, cause I never did drugs in my life. Like that was never my problem, but I wound up working and I did great. I mean, I can remember at least 6 months to a year, I did okay. And life seemed to be on track, but I was still missing this like resentment towards my father, and I was missing this piece of my life, and I had a chip on my shoulder. And next thing you know, I found the wrong crowd, started smoking weed, started drinking, dropped out of high school when I was 17. And then when I dropped out of high school when I was 17, my sister didn't know what to do with me. And I love her to death, because she was like, I don't know what to do. So go back to your mom. And mind you, I haven't lived with my mom since I was 9 years old. So, I mean, there's 11 years of mom trying to discipline me, but I'm not listening to her. Mm-hmm. So 17, high school dropout, and next thing you know, like, it's a chain progression. So I go I wound up going to jail for the first time. And that really wasn't my first time actually behind bars for 30 days. And it was more of a wake-up call. And I wound up going through the same process I did as going through Three Springs. And it was strip and cough and get searched and back to being institutionalized and back to getting jumped because I was a new guy there. Because, of course, now I'm in a different crowd of people. So I'm in a small town that everybody knows everybody. And it's gang people know gang people and dope heads know dope heads. And I'm back in the same cycle again. So I pretty much made a choice at 18 years old that, okay, like, this is going to be my life. I'm institutionalized. This is all I know. I found the people that understand what it's like. And next thing you know, from 18 to 21, I wound up getting locked up so many times that I wound up becoming a felon. And when I became a felon at 21, that was just like a whole nother turning point for me. Like, I am beyond the point of return now. So I'm pretty much just lost in this whole endless cycle of addiction for 6-7 years, you know? And it all stems back from the wilderness camps and having this chip on my shoulder and having this transition period and not being able to talk to my family with therapy. And like, a lot of it was how I felt, but a lot of it also was how I was raised in the programs with expecting people to understand what I was going through. And like, I talk to people today, you know, and I hear the same stories. People reach out to me on Reddit and they'll talk to me. And I've talked to some of the people that I've actually gone through the programs with, and they all say the same thing. You know, it's like, I take away the brainwashing and take away the family aspect of it. Like, what did we get besides getting thrown away for a couple of years and then we're back to the same problem, you know? Like, people have nightmares from just waking up and not knowing how to live. Like, people still have these problems of feeling like they go to work and there's something that triggers them from one of these programs, and it's like a whole PTSD battle. And I don't have a recipe for it, you know? Like, I don't have a magic, like, oh, this is gonna work and this is how I got out of it. Like, I just was lost and somehow became found again. I don't know.
When you go to attend Three Springs, is it your parents that take you there, they drop you off and they leave you there?
Yeah, they drop me off with my stuff, and then they sign some papers that I remember. And I remember as soon as they signed that piece of paper, they said, you are no longer needed, you can leave. And as soon as they left, that's when I went into the room and had to strip and cough.
Right. And what about your belongings? Did you have anything with you that you took there that was taken away from you?
I had a trunk full of stuff, you know, like envelopes, and you can write letters. I mean, you had church on Sunday, and then you went to this like little tiny school, like when you went to school, they had a church service there. And I never went to church because that was the one time that I could like leave the group behind. So essentially they had two separate groups, if you don't go to church and if you go to church. And so there's only myself and one other guy that never went to church, and we stayed at the campsite for hours until they got back. I think it was like a 2-hour church service.
North Carolina is part of the Bible Belt in America. Oh, so yeah. It must have been quite strange for you to be somebody that doesn't have religious affiliations, I imagine, in that part of the world.
No, I remember going down the Wicca. I thought that was my religion, and I wanted to be a Satanist, because it was like, for lack of better words, fuck the world. Like, you left me here. But no, my family's Catholic, you know, and it, that was another big part too, is that, without touching on this subject too much, but the divorce in the family caused a rift in the Catholic Church. And because of the divorce, it made it really weird for my mom to go back to church. Like, the priest wanted my mom to go to marriage counseling and wanted to write out this letter, and she wouldn't let me be an altar boy. And it was it was just real backwards, you know? And now I'm like tattooed up and whatever. So
yeah, it's probably like a whole other thing that I'm sure your mum has some interesting stories about her experiences in the church at that time. And again, she's in a period of her life where she probably needs some level of support, and you would hope that your church and your community would offer you that support, but instead she's judged and shunned and has these experiences where she feels like she's lesser than because her marriage hasn't managed to be sustainable, which for some people is just the way that it goes. It doesn't mean that she's immoral or sinful. So it's really unfortunate that at that point there's a line drawn with the us and them aspect, and your mum is seen in that way, because I'm sure she probably really would have appreciated the support of her congregation at that point. And then you're not allowed to be an altar boy. I'm not sure if that's something that you would have wanted to do, but then to have that opportunity taken away is another thing that's just less than helpful and not supportive.
I mean, a lot of it has to do too with just my mental health and my mom's mental health. And I think that's why I'm glad technology and the way medicine has advanced from the 90s to now, you know, because now we're more focused on like natural based therapies, you know, like instead of shoving down a bunch of medications, like let's get to the root of the problem, you know, especially with my job that I do right now. I get a lot of calls of, oh, I want to harm myself or others. But when I get down to the root problem, it's, oh, I don't really want to do that. I just have a problem and with like my father wanting to tell me what to do and yells at me. So this is just my cry for help. You know, like I think a lot of it has to do with root problems. And I think mine got solved with medications, and then the side effects of the medication made me act out worse. So then all the focus was on me instead of like my mom, you know? I mean, I think a lot of even today, a lot of people put the focus on the kid and it's the kid's problem for acting out. But if you look at the home life and the parent dynamic and the parent supports and their roles, I think it's a bigger piece to that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think with a lot of these wilderness camps that there was a lot of family involved therapy that I can remember, you know, like I remember family day where your family could come out and visit you and we can talk and stuff like that, but it wasn't with a therapist or anything. There wasn't any like in-home training, you know, I mean, I even know programs today, it's called intensive in-home, where a therapist and a counselor come out and talk to you in your home and see the dynamic going on and try to intervene that way. But I think a lot of people just get so caught up in just sending Junior off somewhere else so we don't have to deal with it. Mm-hmm. That Junior comes back worse, and then Junior comes back worse, and then the program didn't do the right job. So, like, let's send Junior to a second program. A lot of traumas happen there, too. I mean, a lot of physical, sexual, and verbal abuse go on.
That should be another one of these commonalities across these programs. There's the institution, there's the institutionalized abuse. There's even spiritual abuse with programs like Teen Challenge that have a focus of religious aspect. There's just untold amounts of verbal abuse in a lot of these programs that we hear about on the show. And then there's the physical abuse and the sexual abuse. And then even just things like inappropriate adults just being generally inappropriate with young adults, just the way that they speak to them or the way that they act with them. Even if we're not hearing the really nefarious extreme ends of abuse that are absolutely still happening today, there's always these conversations about adults just generally being inappropriate.
A lot of it is entry level, lower end jobs, you know. I was even looking into this as well. So like if you go on Indeed.com, Indeed is a normal job search, right? So I'm just gonna search my state, North Carolina, and I'll type in Eckerd. E-C-K-E-R-D, it's Eckerd Connects. So it'll pull up an automatic, like, youth counselor teacher in Fayetteville, North Carolina. So it's a 4 to 6 month program for 36 adjudicated male youth. So adjudicated basically is you're in the juvenile justice system. So either A, complete this program, or B, go back to prison. And so that is pretty much what Eckerd does. And there's a bunch of these, but so.
Okay. So what kind of qualifications or experience do we need to apply for that particular job position?
So for $13 to $15 an hour, 2 years of college in a social or human service field, or a high school diploma, or equivalent with a minimum of 2 years prior experience working with youth required. So you could essentially, I don't know, like, my job would qualify. I mean, I work with youth. I've got 2 years experience. I have a high school diploma. Let me go apply for here and go work out in the wilderness with kids. So then you show up and then you realize that, oh, this isn't like your normal, like, oh, I'm working with foster care kids or people that want help. This is legitimate, like, baby kids that have serious criminal issues going on. So now I have to manage these kids, and they're probably gang affiliated. They probably got substance use backgrounds. Their family dynamic is jails, institutions in the ghetto. You know, like, it's all a generational thing. So then that's when staff show up, and then they're like, I'm not doing this. Like, I'm not taking care of people like this, you know? And it's not like your normal stuff, you know? Even like your licensed clinical specialist, which is your master's degree, it's a LCSW, at $45,000 to $55,000 a year working with this, why would you go in working with a program like this when you can go work somewhere else with half the stress, you know, working as a social worker for $55,000 a year at a normal DSS job, you know, like, not out in the wilderness taking care of criminals, for lack of better words.
On the same kind of subject line as that, though, do you feel like this could potentially be something that adults who are looking for those positions of power or positions where they can be manipulators, do you think that they might look at that and say, oh, it's kind of out in the wilderness, out in the middle of nowhere? I feel like so many of the staff that are mentioned across these programs seem to just be the type of people that really do. Well, they kind of abuse, they abuse the positions that they're in. And then because there's no oversight in these wilderness programs and therapeutic boarding schools that are so separated from everyday society, there's no oversight or accountability. There's nobody making sure that these staff members are acting in a legal capacity.
I don't think in the beginning that's what it is. I think it's a culture. I think when you start out with these kind of programs, you go in and have an idea of what the program is, and you're like, you know what, I want to help people. I want to change. I want to be the change I see in the world. I want to help these kids get better. So you go in green, fresh, brand new ideas, and then you get the staff members that have been there for a while, and they're like, no, this isn't how we run place. This isn't how we run things. So then you have this culture of abuse and manipulation already there. Mm. So then when you get new staff coming in, it's either A, the kids get to you first. Because what I mean by that is, it's kind of like being locked up. You see a new correction officer coming in, and you're like, I want to push the boundaries. Like, is he going to make me lock up when he tells me to lock up? Or can I just stay out in the day room and hang out? You know, like, is she really going to make me get out of the shower? Because they time your showers here at these camps. So I think it's like 5 minute showers. And so 5 minutes up, y'all like, let's go. Is she really going to make me go? Well, I'm just going to stay. You know what? No, I'm not doing it today. Like, I'm going to take a 10 minute shower. You know? And then you kind of like push those staff members into doing like, okay, I'm going to make you leave because I don't like you. Or they become power tripping. And then they get the backing of the culture of the other staff members. And they're like, well, if he's not listening, grab him by the arm and yank him out the shower. And if he don't want to listen to there, throw him on the floor and restrain him. And we'll take him off somewhere else and we'll deal with him. And I think because of culture.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I think I've had so many of these conversations that maybe my perspective is skewed and I'm not being particularly fair on all of the staff members that may attend these programs. And as you were speaking there, it reminded me of a few times that people have said, oh, you know, there was a staff member there. She was very reasonable. She was firm but fair. He was very reasonable. He was firm but fair. You know, I have a lot of respect and time for that particular staff member who did try to make a positive difference. But because of the general layout of the programs and the general culture, it was like they were kind of trying to roll a boulder uphill. It's just a very difficult thing to do. And it also reminded me that a lot of the time, these particular staff members that are very difficult or inappropriate seem to be staff who have attended the programs as residents before they go on to be on the payroll. I don't know if that's something that you particularly experienced in your program when you were at Three Springs.
No, I can't say I have. I mean, I didn't really know too much about that dynamic. I just know from what I look up on job searches, and it's all still the same. Because at one point in time, I did think about, like, oh, it'd be cool to go back and help out somebody else, you know, but...
Yeah, and yeah. to maybe make the experience easier for some of the residents or correct and actually have the desired effect on the participants, as opposed to leaving like you did with such a level of trauma and anger.
That's why I tell people about the peer support program. I mean, I'm pretty sure every state has a peer support program in some aspect, but essentially it's an entry-level certification that the qualifications is 1 year sobriety or 1 year of like mental health change. So if you've been seeing a therapist for a year straight and can document it, you know, but it's a certification program and it allows you to go into a wide range of jobs. I mean, I work with housing and helping people with low income understand how to pay bills, you know, and you come across people in all walks of life with sobriety and you'll find somebody with that certification because, like, you'll find your niche. Because it's not just certification just for, like, social working. I mean, it could be an advocate in a hospital, like a guy overdoses, and you're trying to help him find another program to go to, and you're just an advocate, you know? And it's a way to give back to the community without actually getting involved with, like, your past life and your past traumas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But in some way, I think that's such a great line of work to be in. And it kind of does reflect on your experience in some way, because I guess that when you left these programs, you wouldn't have known how to do things like pay bills, get on the bus, make telephone calls, you know, these kind of everyday.
Just a mental, you know, just somebody just show me.
Yeah, these everyday things that a lot of us take for granted, you know, how to set up a new direct debit, how to go to the bank and deposit a check. Like, a lot of people might not know how to do these everyday things. So when you say that you work with people from lower income families, helping them with those types of everyday activities, maybe that is you kind of doing that for people without realizing. And I think that that's really a fantastic line of work to be in, because you are, as you said, you are giving back to people.
So that's pretty much all I have. I mean, I was just trying to provide a fresh start.
You mentioned in some of your writing to me originally about the sleeping arrangements and the showers of Three Springs being kind of less than desirable for a place that you're sleeping and staying in full time.
Yeah, the showers were in so the building was just a laundry room building. The showers were basically just stalls. I could see the heads of people, but I couldn't see their body. And I remember I still I still have PTSD from this, but the shower mats are like what you see in a restaurant, the thick black mats with the holes in them. And after they get wet and slimy and it gets like really gross and people don't want to touch them. That's the same type of mats are in these stalls. I don't ever remember like physically, because it's all concrete. So I don't ever remember scrubbing these walls down or like deep cleaning or anything. I just remember these shower mats. And so it was 15 minutes in the shower house. It was 5 minute shower, 5 minute get ready, 5 minute get dressed, and all your toiletries were locked up. So you had to have the oldest brother or whoever was on. So it's what we call med box. So it's a guy who carried a medicine box, and he also had the key for the shower room, and he controlled the line. So when I mean controlled the line, he made sure everybody was single file, feet together, hands by your side, not talking.
Is this a staff member or
A peer? This is a peer. Yeah, so it's a peer in my group. And he controlled everything. And so you had to ask him to lock your stuff up and get it out. And so if you go over your shower time, too bad, you're getting out with soapy water, like the timer's cut off. Like you literally have a 5 minute timer. And let's say you don't have your shower shoes. Well, that's too bad. Guess what? You have to take a shower without shower shoes. You just get stand on this mat and take a shower. I mean, it was the grossest thing that I can remember. And then the other one was the sleeping arrangements. Sleeping arrangements is just this tiny, like, sardine can cabin bunk beds. So there was, like, 8 bunk beds that I can remember. And then staff had their own, like, little, like, cot with behind a locked door. So staff actually slept there with you, but they could leave and go as you wanted. And while the staff member was sleeping, there was somebody that was on, like, they paid somebody just to sit by the door and just sit there all night, making sure nobody ran away. And it was heated by a fireplace.
Did you ever have any runaways in your program?
It always happened. But the way these programs work is that they're laid out to where the road into the program is about a mile and a half long. And then once you get to the end of that road on the main highway to the closest store is still another 2.5 miles to go. So, I mean, even if you did run away, like, what store are you going to go to? It's not like there's a McDonald's or a Walmart close by. You can go get a phone and call mommy and daddy. Like, you're out in the middle of country field BFE. Like, so you pretty much just learn not to run away. Because then if you run away, you're going to be in a world of trouble. So now you're not even a part of the campsite. They don't even consider you part of the program at this point. You're just on the lynch mob, and you're just living on a campsite away from the campsite. So all your food is brought to you in a wheelbarrow and dropped off at the campsite, and it's all just like prepackaged like meals that are like MREs, and that was it. And you just work off camp. Like, you don't participate in the program, you don't go to school, you don't talk to your family. You're literally by yourself in an own campsite.
So when you say lynch mob, you mentioned this very briefly before. It's a group that you are asked to go and join because you have kind of broken some.
No, you're not asked to join. You're pretty much forced to join. So it's right. It's the same guy who strip searched me. His name is Mr. Lynch. So we just called it the lynch mob because he was in charge. So he drove a tractor behind the group of kids. Like, I remember this because, like, if you ever got in trouble, it'd be like, all right, like, they'd radio them staff, be like, staff member to lynch, we got one for you. And next thing you know, the big burly guy shows up, grabs you by the arm, and it's like, tells you to march, and you're marching in front of his tractor, and he takes you to the gravel pile, gets you a 5-gallon bucket, you fill it up with gravel, you carry it all the way down to the campsite, and you basically fill trails in, like, you just repave roads, essentially. And you just drop off a bucket of gravel and you turn back around, go back up to the campsite. And it's just this monotonous labor that I remember doing. And like, once I got out, I didn't want to work anymore. I didn't want to go punch a clock at a Subway. Like, I just got done doing this crap for 5 years. Like, let me be a kid.
So. And what types of things might land you in the lynch mob?
Generally speaking, running away. Any assault towards staff or students, anything that's verbally aggressive that they just feel like you need to go, just go on a lynch mob. They also took people. I'm trying to think, because I supervised one of these a couple times, and it was essentially just like a reprieve. Like they wanted another student with them that they knew, because like maybe they thought I could calm them down. And so I have a really vague memory about the reason why, or maybe it was just a reprieve. Like, hey, you've been doing so well, like you can just come hang out. I don't know. I really don't know. But I remember a couple times just hanging out down there for no apparent reason. And it may have been because there was only one person on the lynch mob, little Nate, the little guy I was telling you about. He was the main person on this mob. And I guess they wanted somebody to supervise. I couldn't tell you. But also, he made the punishments work. The way the punishments worked was if one person did it, the whole group stops. So little Nate having a problem at 9 o'clock at night before we're going to bed and trying to go to sleep. Well, it's not just his problem, it's the group problem. So like, let's have a group huddle and figure it out. Bedtime should be at 9, but if we have to go to 12, then that's fine. I remember being woken up one time and being told that, hey, we found out somebody's stealing stuff. Like, let's go figure this out because somebody stole from the kitchen. So the next thing I know, we're running rocks up and down trails at like 4 a.m. Like, I remember specifically like 12 a.m. to 6 a.m. doing bucket duty because somebody got in trouble for some dumb reason. I don't know what it was, but they decided that we're not going to sleep tonight until somebody comes clean. And it was like something dumb, like somebody stole bread from the kitchen, or I don't know, because we had to deep clean the cafeterias like once a month, and every group is assigned to it. And I remember my group being assigned to it and somebody going in the pantry and just eating a bunch of food and just dumb stuff like that that goes on.
Do you feel like then you're kind of all watching each other, like that self-policing thing is then almost implemented because it turns
people against each other, because then you get people that are like always in trouble. So then we're getting pissed because this person is always in trouble. Like, it's always something with this person. And so you basically, instead of it being a group thing, it becomes like a 1v1 thing, you know? I mean, and stuff does go behind closed doors. I mean, I remember in the middle of the heat building a latrine, like a 20-foot hole. I had to do it in both programs. I had to redo the outhouses, and we had to dig like a 20-foot hole. And it's kind of like the movie, it's like the book Holes, like quite literally digging a hole. And staff's not looking around, and next thing you know, like hazing happens, you know? Like, I'm tired of getting in trouble for you. So
yeah.
So we do body shots. Like, don't want anything on the face because staff would know, but we don't want to cause any bruises to break bones. So we just do body shots and like get through to them, you know? And then I didn't realize at this particular program, because it was a bunch of juveniles that were supposed to be in like juvenile hall, that this is the hazing that happened when you were in jail. But then the same thing happened to me when I was in jail 17, 18 years old, and the same thing happened to me. And it like reopened the whole trauma that I never healed from. So then it was like, okay, like this is my life again. You know, and I think a lot of kids wind up going down this dark road, you know, like I don't hear the recovery stories of, hey, I'm sober, hey, I'm alive, I'm doing great, you know, like I'm a survivor. I still hear people that are stuck in this trauma, stuck in this PTSD, and there's nobody there that understands what they're going through, you know. That's just, it's this unknown thing, you know. It's crazy.
And do you have an idea of how much this program cost your parents when you were enrolled in Three Springs?
I couldn't tell you. I mean, it could have been $3,000 a month. I mean, I'm not 100%.
Is it another program where it's very common for somebody to be held back so that the they end up being charged more for their stay?
I could see that being Stone Mountain with the level program. I could see it with this program too, because this program did have levels. I mean, you had to go through 5 levels to graduate. You know, you had to go through four. Then the fifth one was like the 2-week transition phase. So, yeah, I mean, I could definitely see that, you know, because every week you had a progress report. And if your progress report isn't good, or you're not making the correct progressions in therapy, or being just disruptive in school or something, you know, like, they could just be like, you know what, I don't feel like you deserve level two. Like, you can just stay where you are.
Your medication, you said that you were quite vastly medicated in your younger years. Were you still on the same level of medication when you attended the Three Springs program from 15 onwards?
I don't remember. I don't remember taking medication at Three Springs. I never took medication afterwards either. I think my sister turned me to like a therapist and it didn't really work out. I wasn't engaged with it. And then I started self-medicating.
And you mentioned briefly before then about graduation. So is the graduation ceremony something that you remember about your experience with Three Springs?
I remember it. I remember a kid. So they separated the circle by group levels, and then the kid walked around each level and with a rock, and he painted the rock as a memory of his time there, and then he left to go back to high school. His name was Nate Ross was his name. It went by Big Nate because we had two Nates. And so Big Nate was like the oldest brother, and then Little Nate was a troublemaker. And I remember Big Nate graduating, but I don't know if he ever, like, I don't think he bought into like what they were selling. I think he just, I think he was smart enough and old enough to understand, like, if I just do what they want and tell them what they want, then they'll leave me alone. Because he was real gothic, and he listened to a lot of Nine Inch Nails, and I swear he smoked a bunch of weed, and he probably still does. But, like, I mean, that's, like, one memory I have of that kid. You know, he just did what they said, didn't make waves, didn't ask questions, just went along with it, you know?
Mm-hmm. And then graduated and went back home.
Normal life, yeah. I think he might have just been, like, skipping school and hanging out with the goth kids, smoking weed, and that's how he ended up there. I don't ever remember him like transitioning to another program. Like, I don't remember him being like I remember that being his only program he ever went to.
I think it was in the previous episode where I spoke to somebody from the Elan school, where she mentioned that sometimes the people that attended the Elan school were kids that might not be achieving as much in school that parents might like them to, and parents simply just had the money to send them to these programs, so that's why they were there. So, you know, maybe not as in such a precarious situation as somebody like yourself, who's got a lot going on at once and nobody really around that has any idea how to help you cope or how to cope themselves with trying to help you through these things. And when you finally left the program, how long had you been there altogether?
Like 13 months.
And what kind of qualification did you leave with? Any educational certification?
Nope. I got a letter in the mail saying that my dad's not paying for it anymore. My sister's coming to pick me up. And I hadn't seen my sister since I was 9, so probably like 6 years. I mean, I've seen her, but like I haven't actually like lived with her. And I just remember 2 weeks, and she came by and picked up all my stuff, and next thing you know, I'm in Wilmington at the beach, and 6 months go by to try to fit in, and wind up falling in with the wrong crowd and self-medicated with drinking and smoking weed. And, you know, I think that goes back to my medication too, because I mean, eventually I went back when I was 22, I got hooked on methamphetamine. And so I think a lot of it had to do with ADHD and Ritalin. I mean, I see it as a common trend in my career, is that a lot of kids that are addicted to stimulants as a youngin' wind up either A, still doing Adderall as an adult, or B, they graduate in the harder stuff. There's no in between.
So it's almost like a gateway medication to harder substances.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, because if you look at the classification for Adderall, it's considered an amphetamine.
Do you feel like there was another intervention that could have worked for you at that period of time that wasn't medically driven?
I mean, I think they tried everything. I think with my situation, it was just,
there's too much going on, so they figured this would calm me down, you know? Like, cause I mean, they tried therapy, and they tried medication management, and I think at the given time, medication works, but I also think giving Adderall to a six-year-old, there's got to be something different.
So you spend 13 months in the Three Springs program. You leave with your sister. You have this really difficult reintegration into typical life and school and education. You end up falling in with a crowd that leaves you open to experiences of harder substances and drugs. And as you progress through this transitional period, you do become addicted to drugs and involved in criminal activity, which lands you spending time like within the justice system, not just being scared straight in the justice system, but actually being incarcerated.
Yes.
And how do you go from that position there? And I know that you're on call, so I don't want to keep you too long, but how do you go from that particularly difficult period in your life to where you are now? Because as you said, you're 4.5 years sober. You're in a job now that gives back to society. So how have you gone from being in that cycle of drugs, crime, and imprisonment to in the job that you're in now?
So I mean, 21 to 27, it was just, I was trying to find a father figure because I never had a father. That was my own choice. My father did try to make a relationship with me, but I was already jaded and callous from centers that I didn't want anything to do with them. So I was basically searching for a father figure, and I kept finding it in wrong places. I mean, tired. I got tired of being high. I got tired of living this life. My family kicked me out. They gave me an ultimatum of treatment or don't call us.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember Christmas time, living on my own, couch to couch. I burned every single bridge, quite literally. And I just called my aunt. I was like, hey, I'm done. Like, I need help. And so she told me to go to detox, and showed up at detox, 114 pounds soaking wet. And I went to a program in the middle of Georgia, out in bumfuck nowhere in the middle of a field. And it was one of those church Kool-Aid camps, you know, for a year. And it gave me the foundation I needed. You know, like, it wasn't a manipulative program. I mean, it was just pretty straightforward, you know, and it allowed me 10 months to air out my feelings, to air out my problems, and focus on myself and focus on my family. And it gave me that foundation. So I left there and went to a halfway house, and that's where I found the peer support program and got in with doing social work and stayed sober. I mean, I don't do anything. I don't smoke. I don't drink. I'm done. I don't have any desire to want to go back. It's just, you just get so sick and tired of being sick and tired that there's got to be a different way.
It's great that you were still able to reach out to your aunt and tell her, you know, that the life that you were in at that moment was not working for you, and she still held out those lines of communication so that, you know, you could still phone her in that hour and say, like, look, I need some help. Because there are a lot of times we hear these stories where people have burnt those bridges, and the family that they have would not have reciprocated any type of communication from them. So I think it's great that your aunt was still, you know, was still receiving of your olive branch when you did phone her up and say, like, let's try something different. So and then you went on to another program. So this is the third program you're involved in. But you've said that the first one, it did have coercive tactics, but it wasn't as bad as the second program. The second program was hideous, awful, has left you with some significant trauma. And then the third program, a few years later, actually did did work for you and gave you the tools and time that you needed to actually get yourself on your feet.
Yeah, because I wanted it. When you actually want to get sober and you want to try a different life, you know, you'll do just about anything. I mean, I can spend the same amount of energy going to the Dope Man, or I can spend the same amount of energy trying to make a better life for myself.
But even that being said, there must be some people that go into these troubled teen programs and want to do better or want to get home and be with their family and are still subjected to these awful things like cavity searches at such a young age. That is just something that should never happen to such a young person.
Family and the family doesn't believe them because the school tells the family, oh no, that didn't happen. I don't know what he's talking about. He must be talking something different.
Must be manipulating you into thinking or feeling things that aren't true, which is just absolutely not right. Some of the things that we come across in this podcast. And then people who were struggling with things like drinking and drugs before they were enrolled into these programs and taken in the middle of the night by the goon squad, like you spoke about at the start of the episode, then still go on after these programs to have a life full of alcohol and drugs on a dangerous level, which speaks to the efficacy of these programs. They're not doing what they're supposed to do for the price that they cost and the promise that they make to families, and actually probably escalate in some cases the drug use for people. You know, you're nodding your head there, so I don't know if that's something that you can speak to.
No, I'm just agreeing. I'm agreeing with what you're saying. I'm trying to I had a text message coming in, so I'm trying to take care of work at the same time.
That's I've just got one more question before I let you go today. I think you've given us some really fantastic insight, as we mentioned before, especially about the transition into the reintegration into society after these programs, which is not something that is supported in any way. So what is the answer for so-called troubled teens, for juveniles, for people involved in gang life, for people who are getting involved in criminal activities or experimenting with alcohol and drugs, and for families who feel like there's nowhere else or nothing else that they can try for their children? What would you say is the answer that is not these wilderness programs or therapeutic boarding schools that actually are only encouraging institutionalized abuse?
I mean, social workers are overstaffed, you know, with a lot of these cases, but I really think trying to keep the kids in the community and keeping it community-based instead of pulling them out or sending them to a family member in another state with services already set up. Now, I'm not saying, like, take Junior and send him to Texas with his aunt that he's never met before, you know, but like maybe over the summer take a family vacation down there and then try to find services in the area, like community-based mentorship programs, like at-risk youth programs, and see if you can get Junior involved during the summer. That way it's a smoother transition. If you're like, hey, like I think you're doing great down here, how about you try to start school down here since you already know the friends? So instead of taking Junior from North Carolina to Texas and just dropping them off with nothing, set up a support plan and community-based supports in that specific area. That way he already has something to transition into. Because if you take Junior and just drop him off, then he's going to be pissed at the family that they just threw him off like he's yesterday's news. And then he's going to carry around that chip on the shoulder and he's going to go find the same crowd that he just left that you're trying to get him away from.
So community, peer support, and utilizing the programs that are available to young people that aren't necessarily these ones that are out in the middle of nowhere where there is no oversight and no accountability. Fantastic. So thank you so much, Andrew. I know we've been a little bit on the rushed side today. I know that you are all cool for work, so I do appreciate you coming here and giving us your time today, telling us your story, giving us a little bit of insight into the two programs that you attended. And also just to highlight again, that difficult period of leaving these programs when you've been involved for a number of years, and then having that transition and reintegration into typical society, typical education, and navigating those murky waters when you have never developed or have lost the skill of socializing and just typical everyday life. So I do appreciate you bringing that particular piece forward for us today. And I will say thank you and let you go, just in case work do give you a call. So excellent chat today, and thank you so much, Andrew.
Thank you for having me on.
Enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you.
Bye.
That is the end of this week's episode. If you'd like to get in touch, you can find me at cultvaultpodcast@gmail.com or follow me on Twitter and Instagram at cultvaultpod. I'm your speaker, Casey, and this has been The Cult Vault.